I'm Lance Carter, and you're listening to the Daily Actor Interview Podcast. When I was at South by Southwest, I got a chance to see one of the most violent, twisted, and funniest movies I'd seen in a while, James Gunn's Super. Starring Rainn Wilson, Ellen Page, Liv Tyler, and Kevin Bacon, the film is about a guy named Frank. He's a cook whose wife leaves him for another man. His pain soon turns into anger, and he's dressing in a makeshift superhero garb, whacking, literally, evil. His alter ego, Crimson Bolt, takes on a sidekick, Bolty, and the two set out to clean up their city. From people butting in line at the movies to drug dealers, no one is safe. It was nice to see Rainn Wilson, and especially Ellen Page, do something completely different on screen, and for that, you have to thank Gunn. I talked to James at South by Southwest, where, with a sandwich and fries in hand, he talked about how his ex-wife, Jenna Fischer, got Rainn involved, the casting of the film, and how he came up with the design of the costumes. This site takes a lot of work, so I really do appreciate it when you support our advertisers. And now, here's James.
You mentioned Ellen and Rainn. I mean, those are two kind of unique personalities that seem to fit very well with this movie, not just hanging out, but getting them to play the parts that they do.
Yeah.
In the movie as well.
Yeah. Well, Rainn I've known for a long time, and he is he fits the role of Frank Darabo quite well, but I had never thought of him. I had wrote this movie back in 2002. My ex-wife, Jenna Fischer, called me up. We had funding a long time ago, but I made Slither instead of Super. It was a long story, but my ex-wife, Jenna Fischer, called me up, and she said, we're still very close friends, and she said, "What are you doing with Super?" And I said, "Nothing. It's a little bit of a weird movie. It's very violent. There's a lot of tonal shifts. I'm just not sure we can make this movie." And she says, "Well, I really want you to make that film. That's my favorite script you've ever written, and I think that story should be told." And I said, "Okay, that's good, Jenna." And then she said, "Have you ever thought of Rainn to play the role of Frank?" And it was like, yeah, it's weird. I'd been friends with him for a long time, and I just had never thought of it. I'm like, yeah, okay. So she kind of orchestrated this whole thing because she was off talking to Rainn about something and me, and she's the one who put it all together. She had some little evil woman thing that she did. And then she went and she talked to Rainn about it, and she got me to send the script to Rainn, which I did. And then Rainn wrote me, you know, an hour and a half later, and he says, "I'm 22 pages in, my hands are shaking, I'm in." And I was like, "Rainn, there's a lot of violence that comes up in the movie. Let's, once you get to the end of the script, before you say you're in." And he's like, "Nah, I'm in. And he was. And so from that time forward, we didn't stop. And, you know, kind of kept going and got Ellen and Liv. And Liv is actually the one who got the movie made because she is a big foreign salesperson, because all of her movies are huge. So she's the biggest star in the movie. Because of you know, Lord of the Rings and Incredible Hulk and The Strangers, all of these movies are big, big hits. And she hadn't done a movie, I think, in 2 years when she did this movie. So, yeah.
With a movie like this, I would think the actors have to be completely just all in. Mm-hmm. You know, was it hard to find a set of actors like that, you know?
We're kind of lucky with it. I mean, it was like, you know, Ellen just, you know, of course she didn't audition for the movie. I didn't know her outside of just meeting with her on the project. But, you know, from the first day on set, she has to jump out of her car in her bra in 14 degrees weather and yelling at these people and going crazy. And she was obviously committed 100%. And she almost fainted on set numerous times to prove it. So I knew she was. Liv, I knew a little bit more. I had hung out with Liv a lot before this movie. So I knew that she was really on board for anything, you know. For instance, in the movie, she gets her foot shot up with heroin, and she insisted that it was her real foot in the movie, and that's her foot
about that.
On screen. So it's, yeah. And then the most of the actors in the movie were friends of mine. I mean, you know, Nathan Fillion and Michael Rooker and Greg Henry, I'd all use them in Slither, and we hang out a lot. My brother Sean and my friend Stevie Blackheart and Valentine Mealy and Lloyd Kaufman were all in, you know, from Romeo and Juliet days. Stevie Blackheart's my best friend. Sean's my brother. Linda Cardellini is one of my two or three best friends in the world. I knew her from the Scooby-Doo movie. So all those people I knew very well and knew what they were capable of, and was just really grateful that they wanted to come down to Louisiana and work for no money.
But you mentioned Slither, and one of the things that I loved about this movie and Slither, and you also talked about the violence, is how I feel like it's almost kind of making a comeback, like, in just because it feels like you don't really see it in movies anymore, that kind of violence, and it's almost refreshing and cool to see it at that level. Even in the other superhero movies where people are dying, there's no...
Yeah.
There's no blood or bruising or anything.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that, you know, when you knock somebody out in real life, you have like a 20% chance of killing them when you knock somebody unconscious. And yet, people in the movies are running around knocking each other out all the time. They fall down, they wake up an hour later, everything's fine. This movie is really about what really happens. You know, you see somebody hit somebody with a pipe wrench in a movie, it's like, boom, they fall unconscious. Here you see the guy's head split open, you see what it really is. And I think it's interesting. I mean, in Slither, our gore was actually much more cartoony than in this movie. This movie is much more real. In Slither, everything's so over the top. It's actually much easier to watch. We get way more gasp from the violence in Super than we did in Slither, simply because it's unexpected for one. In a horror movie, you're watching it, and it's in the context of a horror movie. And number two, just because it was so over the top, everything was cartoonish in a way.
What was the decision to use the? The
pipe wrench?
Yeah.
It just seemed like a thing I wouldn't want to get hit with, you know? So I think, you know, if I was fighting somebody, it's not a bad thing to grab.
True, yeah. And I won't say it in the interview, but the decision to kill one of the characters.
Yeah.
And you said last night that was, like, in the first draft.
Right.
That's just hearing the gasps around me, you know?
Yeah, that's
like
really...
It was a complete shocker.
Yeah.
You know, you just never... Never expect it.
Yeah, never expect it. You know, even up until he sees her, that's what I like about it. I mean, it's like Rain and I were talking about it last night. I mean, how many movies have you seen where, you know, the second lead gets, you know, hit by a bullet or, you know, is partially drowned or something, and then the other guy goes over to that person and they pull him over and they're like, oh no, are they dead? And then it's, you know, they're
exactly
okay.
I
mean, you've seen it a thousand times in movies, and we totally defy that expectation, you know, and it's very interesting. People do not expect that she's dead, even if we kind of see her get shot in the head and fall down. People don't expect her to be dead until that moment they see half her face missing.
Yeah.
Is that one of the challenges of making a movie, especially at this kind of level, is like, okay, you're making a superhero movie. It's like, you got to find out, okay, what can I do that hasn't been seen to make this movie stand?
Well, you know, listen... I find it's almost the opposite. I find that, you know, a lot of people are very comforted going to a movie and knowing exactly what to expect. I just saw Unstoppable on the pay-per-view the other night. It's not a bad movie. You know exactly what's going to happen in that movie from scene to scene. I mean, there is nothing in that movie you don't know what's going to happen, you know?
Based on the trailer.
Based on, like, the first 3 minutes of the movie, you know that, you know, what's-his-face is going to get back together with his wife at the end of the movie. You know, they're both going to live. Nobody's going to die. You know, they're going to stop the train. Nothing's going to blow up. You know every single thing that happens at the end of the movie. And yet, you still kind of feel this tension, but it's not so much tension that it's uncomfortable. A lot of people are not comfortable with what's in Super. They just aren't. Because the tension is the kind where you really don't know what's going to happen. You don't know who's going to live. You don't know who's going to die. You don't really even know who's right and wrong. I mean, there's, you know, is Frank a crazy guy? Or does he have a real point? You know, is he called by God? Is he not? You don't know any of that, and that makes it an uncertain thing for people, and you have to have a taste for that. You know, they have tests for people and their who like different types of music. There's actually a scale, and on one end is the scale of people who like music that you know exactly what's going to come next in the song. It's like those very familiar, it's not even pop songs, like what would be like teen pop, you know, like, you know, the Hansons of the world, like that sort of thing. I guess Justin Bieber's of the world now. But you'd have, you know, very familiar stuff towards people at the end who like experimental music where you don't know what's going to happen from moment to moment. And it's just where people's taste can lie anywhere along that spectrum. And it has nothing to do with what's right or wrong. It just has to do with taste. And with a movie like Super, we are way over there. We're towards the experimental side because you don't know what's going to happen. Yet within that, we have all these, we have this imagery that's very familiar to people, the imagery of the superhero, the imagery of the, you know, big stars, you know, a lot of different things that are familiar to people. So, you know.
Well, it's kind of funny that you mentioned that, just because, like, when, that's a lot of, I guess it's, as you mentioned, it's comforting, but it can also be something that people complain about. It's like, oh man,
right.
Like, I knew what was going to happen in that movie before I ever saw it. Like,
listen, I know I made a remake of a horror movie, Dawn of the Dead, and everybody complains about remakes of horror movies. Oh no, another fucking remake! Oh, another remake! Another fucking remake! Yet every single time an original horror movie comes out, nobody goes to see it. It's like, shut the fuck up, you know. And also, even the fact that you're here commenting on the Dawn of the Dead page as opposed to commenting on the Innkeepers page or whatever, you know, shows that even you are the one who's, like, centering the conversation around the remakes and not around the original idea, you know? And that's, you know, that's the way people are. You know, they complain about something while simultaneously, you know, clinging to it.
I think it's a lot easier to complain about stuff.
It is.
No?
Yeah, it is. Complaining is easy.
How did you come up with the look of the costumes?
Well, Crimson Bolt is very specific, and I needed a lot of things from that costume, but the one word I kept using was Frankensteinian, because I wanted to look like this crazy guy had made the costume, you know, who's totally OCD, and he, like, you know, he puts it on, it's ill-fitting, it's too tight, so he cuts it open and adds a patch, and then it's too loose, and so he has to cut it again and then just tighten it up, and he does that all over the Cole costume so that it looks demented. But it also had to have a specific effect where the costume could look funny in scenes where, you know, that were more based around the humor, and at the end of the movie it almost looks like he's a fucking demon.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to have both of those aspects to it, and I actually drew the original costumes, and that's what we based it on. Bolte's costume, we did the opposite. We put absolutely no thought into it whatsoever. I said, you know, make it something that a girl can make, that she's going to do largely from buying stuff in American Apparel, that's sort of sexy and fetishistic, and she's much more worried about the way she looks in it than any practical use whatsoever, and that's what that was. So I think I saw Bolt. I went through countless revisions of the Crimson Bolt costume. I saw Bolte one time, like the day before we shot it, and I made one change, and then went to it again. Yeah.
Were you influenced by? I mean, you're a comic book fan. Like,
yeah.
What kind of influences did you have on this movie?
Well, I would say Alan Moore is the biggest influence of all. I mean, he's the guy that really started the deconstruction of the superheroes back with the Watchmen. I have the original Watchmen comics, I think he's one of my biggest influences in the world, not only as a comic book writer, but I think he's one of the greatest living writers. So, Alan.
That's, I think, that really, it's funny you mentioned that. I think it really does come across that one of the things I enjoyed about the movie was that you have this one feeling right after you watch it about how you feel about what the Crimson Bolt is doing, what he's trying to do, and then later on you're kind of thinking, wait a second, am I supposed to root for this guy? Or,
yeah.
It makes you think.
Yeah.
It feels like
thanks,
it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the movies like that was have you ever seen Unforgiven?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think so. I always liked Unforgiven. That was a big influence on me, because at the end you're watching Edward Money, you know, shoot all those people. And on the one hand, you're like, oh, I love watching them kill those sons of bitches. And on the other hand, you're like, well, wait a second. You know, those horrors don't really have a reason to, like, you know, kill that kid. And you shouldn't kill that kid. And Gene Hackman is really, in a way, just trying to do his job. And he's not any better than you. But, like, you're still rooting for him. But it you're questioning it at the same time. And to have both those experiences at the same time, for me, while watching Unforgiven, was a real powerful experience.
Thanks, James, and thank you for listening. Keep coming back to Daily Actor for more great interviews, news from film, TV, and theater, and so much more. Thanks for supporting the advertisers. I'm Lance, and I'll talk to you soon.